I see the participants streaming in. We're going to wait for just a minute and let everybody get accumulated here. Looks like we've already started to get questions coming in.
Wow.
I think they don't realize that the questions need to be relevant to this particular subject.
Yeah, they may ask about some philosophical, theological question, have to refer it to Ken Samples.
Yeah. Well, last week I got to answer one, so it was fun.
Oh, great. Yeah. It sounds like a good interaction with everyone.
Yeah, this is a good group, a really good group. Mary, do you have a thank you from Belinda Calabia saying thank you, Dr. Eric Hedin, for joining us. So You haven't even said anything and the people are already happy you're here.
That's, again, a perfect audience.
Okay, with that, I'm going to start us because I know that the group is going to start slowly moving in. So what I'd like to do is right now first make some announcements. The opening of Paradoxes class in person will occur in 2 weeks. So not Easter Sunday, but the Sunday after that. We'll be meeting at 1:15 at the Reasons to Believe headquarters. We'll say more about it next week to make sure that that's tight, but that's what you should expect. We'll still be doing it on Zoom, but we'll be having it live. And so anyone who lives in the area is welcome to come. We actually encourage you to come at 1:15 p.m. Pacific time. And Hugh Ross will be teaching as he has when he was at the church. So we're kind of happy that the opening for people showing up live is going to occur very soon. We'll especially give thanks to Jamie because he's the tech guy and he's the one who's making sure that all of that's going to work. So thank you, Jamie, for getting your team together. And we'll talk more about it next week. All right. Well, with that, let's get this rolling here. So welcome to Hugh Ross's Paradoxes class. This morning, we have a guest speaker. I'm very happy to have Dr. Eric Hedin.
Yes.
Dr. Hedin has a PhD in physics, has taught physics and astronomy at Biola and Ball State University in Indiana. He's a longtime friend of RTB, almost from its inception. And one of the most important things to me is he's a member of the scholar community. And the RTB scholar community is a group of handpicked scholars who are volunteers who are working to work as scholar evangelists out in the broader community. And so, Dr. Hedin, thank you so much for doing that. We really appreciate you magnifying the work of the scholars at Reasons to Believe. You are an extension of Reasons to Believe, and we deeply appreciate you for doing that. And so with that, I would like to turn it over to Dr. Hedin. Dr. Hedin, it's all yours, and thank you again for doing this for us.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mark, for the introduction. And I just want to start off by saying I am very grateful to be able to have this opportunity to share in this class. It's quite an honor to share in a venue where Dr. Ross normally is the speaker. And so as Mark mentioned, I've been very much blessed by Hugh Ross's work and Reasons to Believe in general. I can remember at least since the early 1990s and many of the books that have been published, I've read almost all of them, have really helped me in my teaching and my own thoughts about the integration of faith and science. So that idea of the integration of faith and science has been almost like a lifelong sense of calling for me. And my PhD is in experimental plasma physics from University of Washington, and I've done research in that field and then switched to other topics of research when I was at Ball State University in Indiana, where I taught for 15 years in their physics and astronomy department. I mainly focused my research on computational nanoelectronics, essentially doing experimental kind of research on the computer, designing nanoscale electronic circuits and discovering how they work. But I also taught a class there that I designed, and it was called The Boundaries of Science. I taught it in the Honors College at Ball State for about 6 years. It was focused mostly on cosmology and astronomy, some physics, some little bit of biology, but primarily looking at nature and studying what we know about nature and asking the question if natural processes can explain everything that we see in existence. And I'll go further with that thought as we go along here through the talk, but it led to me writing a book which has been titled Canceled Science, Scientific Discoveries That Some Atheists Don't Want You to See. It's kind of the essence of the subtitle, and published by the Discovery Institute just over a year ago. So again, it's a privilege to be here. I'll give you a little outline of my talk. I'll go over this class that I taught at Ball State and why that's relevant to the conversation today. One of the main questions I think that we can consider, and I hope that maybe you'll provide some feedback and some of your own questions, does examining the implications of science amount to teaching religion? And so you can think about that, what that might mean. In the case of my class, apparently some atheist antagonists thought that it did amount to teaching religion, and which led to some conflict. But then after I talk through that, I would like to, if we have time, just discuss some of my favorite examples of evidence for something beyond nature, beyond those boundaries of science, as I call them. You can see some of the topics listed there. So the Boundaries of Science course was sort of designed to, I guess, highlight human significance in the light of what nature can and cannot do. I realized that a lot of my science students, or students in general who had taken a science course, maybe even just for a general ed requirement to be satisfied while they were at university, were probably exposed to the idea that humans are just nothing but a speck of dust on a planet in the middle of nowhere in the universe, and it's a vast universe, and so that, you know, we are less than insignificant. And I thought that rather than hammering on that idea, let's look at evidence that perhaps speaks a different story. And this is an actual clip from the course description of this Boundaries of Science course, which I introduced in about 2007 at Ball State University. Again, taught it for 6 years in the Honors College there. It was always 25 students, which was the cap. And it was my favorite course to teach. I would teach it once or twice or three times a year, and very good reviews by the students. So again, my goal was to help them to appreciate the scope and wonder of the physical reality. You know, when you teach astronomy, that's not hard to do. There's so much that's fascinating and even beautiful. But as a key part of the course, it was designed to allow students to discuss what are the implications of science. You know, let's say the Big Bang model for the origin of the universe implying a beginning. Well, what does that imply? And could that point to something beyond physical reality? And of course, teaching at a secular university, I would want to present the evidence and allow them to reach their own conclusions and not to explicitly say, this means that God created the universe, but to allow them to kind of look at the evidence and see if in their minds it was consistent with that type of a conclusion. The course actually grew out of my teaching of astronomy at Ball State, again, I realized that as a Christian, I couldn't just promote the idea of God in the classroom. But I did feel like it was legitimate to let the students ask questions that we could perhaps even discuss. So I would ask questions in the classroom, like, what's the meaning of our existence? And actually that question came out of one of my astronomy textbooks that started off saying that astronomy can help us to understand the meaning of our existence. And so they would respond with a wide range of answers. I would have maybe 100 students in a given section of astronomy, and I'd take their answers, which they would write down and hand in, and I'd read them over in a coffee shop somewhere, and it was just fascinating. I'd kind of summarize the answers into categories, and so I did this over and over and over for years, and I had well over 1,000 student responses that I could kind of gain an understanding of this, what's on students' hearts, really. Sometimes the meaning of their existence, they would say, there is no purpose, there is no meaning. Others were clearly Christians and spoke of their meaning as connected with knowing God or being disciples of Christ. And others said, the meaning of our existence is to live, reproduce, and die. Obviously, having been influenced by something other than a scriptural worldview. One of my favorite questions to ask was to let them ask a question. So I would ask, what one question would you most like answered? If you could have any question in the world answered, I'd make it clear that I wasn't just trolling for something having to do with physics or astronomy, any question in any topic. And it was consistent that the most popular category of question that the students at the secular university would most like answered had to do with God. They really wanted to know, how can I get to heaven? Is there life after death? They would sometimes ask back to the first question, what's the meaning of it all? Other questions were more career focused. They would have humorous ones now and then. But it told me that students really had a deep yearning to understand what we might consider to be metaphysical realities, metaphysical issues that college students may seem like they're just there for a good time. Perhaps that's someone's stereotypical opinion. But I can tell you from experience that they really do have deep questions on their minds. So another question, which is more directly tied to the title of my course that I developed called The Boundaries of Science, was a question where I would ask the students, can science explain everything? Or are there limits to what science can explain? Meaning, are there limits to what can be explained naturally? So again, some said yes, maybe we haven't got it all figured out yet, but science is going to explain everything someday. Others said no, ideas like emotions or maybe things like true love can't be explained scientifically. Some would say, science is never going to explain my girlfriend, things like this. But It did highlight that some students had a confidence in science that I think was actually unwarranted, and others realized that there were things that kind of were outside of the boundaries of science. So this led me to write this article, Questions from the Edge, using informal surveys to build rapport with students. And that essentially was what I did with these questions. I would feedback to the students, their answers in class over the semester, and just say, let's just talk about this a little bit. Here's what some of you said. And I felt like that did succeed at building rapport with students. So as that statement from this article says there at the bottom of the page. If we acknowledge that student interest extends beyond the surface content of our course, I believe we automatically build a stronger bridge of communication with students. And I feel like that's so important as a professor or teacher, probably a pastor, anybody, try to address questions that students are, or your audience is really interested in as much as you can. So this is the particular just title page of the article published in the Journal of College Science Teaching. And so that was published about the same time that I began and proposed this course at Ball State University. And so I was happy that the Dean of the Honors College approved it, and it got approved by all the appropriate university curriculum committees and so on. It was even approved as a core curriculum science course that satisfied that credit. So again, a couple of questions that I think are relevant throughout the talk here for us to ponder, and maybe we could have further discussion after the formal presentation time is ended. So does discussing scientific evidence that might conflict with the paradigm of naturalism equate with teaching religion in a science course? I could imagine some people might say there is no scientific evidence that conflicts with the paradigm of naturalism because they've already made up their mind that naturalism is all there is. But of course, to make up your mind that naturalism is all there is, we could ask, is that a scientific conclusion? So can the study of nature inform metaphysical questions, or can the study of nature inform questions beyond nature? And I would say yes, because how could we even know where the boundary between the physical and the metaphysical lies without thoroughly understanding physical nature? If we have a kind of a uninformed view of nature, we may think that natural processes can accomplish things that they actually cannot accomplish. So I believe that studying nature could at least illuminate the question, is it natural? And again, some people may assert that everything is natural, just as a presuppositional approach to life. But again, we could ask, is that approach a scientific approach, or is it an opinion, a belief system that's superimposed on their study of nature? So after I taught this Boundaries of Science course at Ball State for, it'd been going 6 years, I suddenly found myself in the midst of a conflict. And I say faith at work turning into conflict at work because even though I was very aware of kind of what was appropriate, not appropriate in the classroom for me as a professor to bring up at a secular university, my faith was behind and in my life, of course, and yet even trying to express that through making available to students the opportunity to discuss implications of science that could point beyond it. Maybe I wouldn't have quite taken that tactic if I had been an atheist, a naturalist. So the question that may be appropriate, again, is to ask, was that inappropriate for a professor at a university, or within the boundaries of what's perhaps legitimate? And I have my own opinions on that, but I'd be happy for feedback as well. So this is an example of many media articles that began to rise up around me in about 2013. So from the local paper, the Muncie Star Press, which is where Ball State University is in Indiana, the local reporter said that Ball State is investigating a complaint that one of its professors, I was an assistant professor, untenured at that time, is preaching rather than teaching. So suddenly, I'm preaching in the classroom. Other people who were obviously coming from an atheistic worldview wrote to me, you know, emails and things that arrived in my inbox, accusing me of pushing Jesus down students' throats and trying to promote beliefs that were on a par with saying the earth is flat, things like that. So the university really didn't support me. I thought that they would kind of take my back since, you know, I'd had a good reputation there. I'd been working there at that time for 10 years. And the reason I wasn't tenured yet was that for 8 of those years, I had been just a contract faculty. I'm glad I was in a tenure track position at that time. It allowed me to have a little more job security. But what do you do when you get in the midst of this kind of conflict? And again, taking it in the context of our faith, the Bible has a lot to say about what to do when you find yourself as a believer encountering some persecution. First of all, I think we shouldn't be surprised. In the world, you have tribulation, Jesus said. And Paul's words, for it has been granted to you that for the sake of Christ, you should not only believe in him, but also suffer for his sake. That's been granted to us. He almost makes it sound like a privilege, which honestly, I can say I feel like it is. Although I can also honestly say it is one of the most difficult experiences of my life. And I've been through some of the major hardships of life that people go through, but this was not a picnic. So we can expect it. Jesus even encourages us to rejoice when we are persecuted for righteousness' sake. When men revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. And I thought that was what was going on entirely. I couldn't believe the things that were spoken about what I was doing in the classroom, all by people who had never been in the classroom with me at this course. But it was advised to me to not enter the fray and not try to publicly defend myself. And I'm very glad for that advice. So the reward is great in heaven. I'm thankful again for that privilege. You're blessed. Now this is interesting because I would say a year or so before this all began at Ball State, this persecution, I really felt like the Lord spoke to me one time saying about my time at Ball State, I will bless you there. And of course, I'm thinking the usual blessings like smooth sailing, favor, all of that, which God gave me a lot of favor, but I didn't expect this persecution. But maybe I should have if I'd have been reading 1 Peter 4, 13 and 14. If you are insulted for the name of Christ, you are blessed. And so God's blessings, he sees things from Christ's perspective, from the eternal perspective, and it is a blessing to participate even at the most minor level with suffering for the name of Christ. So I write here, armor up, it just means that as Paul encouraged the believers, put on the full armor of God and realizing that our battle is not against people, as it says, not against flesh and blood, but against the principalities, the spiritual hosts of wickedness. And I'll say more about that. This is important. Our enemies, even in something like this, are not the human people. They may be most directly invisible to us, But the ultimate adversary is on a spiritual plane, the enemy of our soul, the world rulers of this present darkness, as Paul calls them. So we need armor that is also of a spiritual value. And so Ephesians gives us a good list of that type of armor. And I'm thankful that the Lord has, over the years, kind of strengthened me in believing the truth of the gospel and knowing my righteousness is in Christ and my peace with God is secure through faith in Christ. That faith is like a shield and the salvation is secure, and that the word of God is true and it's powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword. So those realities are real. I can assure you of that. And they really helped me and my wife to be able to stand strong during that time. The other thing that I think is encouraging when at all suffering for the sake of Christ is to realize you're not alone. And even the Bible, again, assures us of this, that we've been called to this experience, and that we might follow in the steps of Christ, and that we can be assured that there are people throughout the world who name the name of Christ who are suffering in some, what I would consider a much more traumatic way. And so there were many who were just befriending me during that time, who reached out to me, people from the Discovery Institute in Seattle, were in communication with me regularly, and giving advice and kind of supporting me in the media without actually letting me or having me be on the front lines. And so I appreciate that. I can remember getting a card signed by all of the Reasons to Believe staff during this time. And it literally just took me up. I was so thankful that people, you know, at that time, who I'd never met, would reach out to me and be supportive. And a few people who, again, I'd never known or before, just called me out of the blue. One of them was Pastor Rice Brooks, who wrote the book God's Not Dead, that eventually got turned into the movie by that name. He came up to visit me from Nashville to Muncie, and has been a real encouragement, and was actually the one who encouraged me to write a book about my class and what I taught and about this story as well. That's the book that again came out last year called Canceled Science. So again, you're not alone. We can entrust ourselves to God, and that's, if I can just sort of summarize, what did the Lord do during that time? He encouraged us to entrust ourselves to God, to not try to, think that we can just go out there and fight this on our own. And in particular, it was to take almost the harder way of keeping silent and allowing the Lord to let this work out the way he wanted to, rather than, again, trying to set the record straight and go into a defensive posture of fighting back. So he has restored and strengthened and established me. I've been very grateful. I ended up getting first promoted at Ball State to associate professor just a year or two after this kind of settled out. They canceled my class, The Boundaries of Science, but they fortunately didn't take away my job. And then I got tenure at Ball State a couple years after this event, and stayed on another 3 years after that before I went to Biola University, where I was invited to work at Biola's newly established School of Science, Technology, and Health as professor, and work in the Department of Chemistry, Physics, and Engineering there. So God is good. Very good. And again, we have to realize that the Lord is intimately involved. Like he said to Paul, who was Saul at that time, saying, Saul, why do you persecute me? Well, Saul was persecuting followers of Christ, but Jesus took it personally. And so the battle really is the Lord's, and he will fight for us. And I know he will fight for you if you ever are in a situation like this. Now, one of the key things that I'm grateful, so grateful for, that the Lord has impressed on my heart, actually, while I was living in Southern California and teaching at Biola, was to step into the role that Christ showed us at the cross when he was on the cross saying, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. We're coming up to Easter Sunday and remembering Christ's sacrifice for us. And I want us to just realize that the most innocent one, the most loving, perfect person who ever lived, Christ the Son of God, when he was being completely unjustly persecuted, didn't retaliate in anger. It said, Father, forgive them. And I believe that Jesus invites us as his followers. And this is the most maybe important thing for us to step into as Christ's followers, is that same role of asking for forgiveness for those who persecute us. Asking for forgiveness for those who are doing wrong, and to extend that grace. Peter calls us a royal priesthood. And if you study in the Bible, as I've been doing over this last few years, the role of a priest, it's to make atonement for the people based on the sacrifice that is offered. Now the sacrifice is Christ. It's complete and it's done and it's sufficient. And as priests, under the high priesthood of Christ, I believe that we have this role of extending forgiveness. So I want to speak that out as well for those who were behind the persecution, whether it was associations or organizations or individuals. Father, forgive them in Jesus' name, for they don't know what they were doing. And I believe that the key here is that as we forgive, the Lord Jesus can extend his hand of authority over their lives and bring about his will. Jesus rules. He continuously makes intercession for us, and his throne is a throne of grace. Throne of grace. So Jesus rules through extending grace. Through us. I mean, of course, there's coming a time when he will come again and put a stop to all that's opposing him. But we have this opportunity to extend grace in his name now. And I think that's pretty clear from the scriptures. Jesus himself spoke this out. Paul spoke this out. Peter spoke this out. And, you know, I think... I'm speaking this out in agreement with this, and it's been freeing for me to be able to forgive those who persecute. My wife and I have come into this together and are able to experience the freedom of Christ in kind of putting it in the Lord's hands and asking God to bless those who persecute us. So I just want to say that because I know that, you know, if you're tuned into this broadcast, you're probably, or this class Zoom meeting, you're probably very aware of the conflict. You know, it may not have been quite as intense where you are, or maybe it has been, but you're aware of there's a almost an us versus them attitude that can develop. It's us having the privilege of being able to extend the grace of God in Christ Jesus to all people. And that's what we get to walk in with the Lord's help. I'm thankful for that. So I'm going to just transition a little bit now for the rest of the talk and share a few thoughts that I feel like are significant relating to the boundaries of science that support design or support God as creator. And one of the things that I really find a lot of joy in thinking about from scripture and then trying to understand from my study of the natural world is that the world was created through Christ and for him, as it says in Colossians chapter 1, all things in heaven and on earth. So that means that we probably, if I can borrow the title of Hugh's first book, we probably really can see the fingerprint of God, the fingerprint of Christ upon the natural world. And that makes it more of a joy to study. So how could we see nature reflecting the image of the Creator? We would expect that the universe should have an imprint, just like a painting by a famous painter would have markings of his style, would have characteristics, and maybe even the theme and the way he handles certain subjects. He or she, as a painter, embeds part of their values and likes and loves and sense of beauty into the painting that they have made. This quote from George MacDonald at the bottom of the screen, emphasizing that examining nature, not just to know whether or not God exists, but I think to know the heart of the Creator. And I believe that we can glean some even of the heart of the Creator. And as MacDonald says, it's of far more consequence what kind of God than whether or not God exists. And so I believe that by studying nature, we can glean a little bit of the heart of God and seeing his design that is so well tuned to not just give us the bare essentials for life, but to be able to fully enjoy life. So a couple things here. I would emphasize in terms of evidence, that is evidence that I believe in nature points to a creator and points to a limitation of nature, limits of naturalness. And one of them I'll say is the limits of randomness, because ever since I've been old enough to think about science, I've heard the idea that if you wait long enough, anything can happen, which as a physicist now, I believe is pure nonsense. The universe is not a genie in a bottle. It is not omnipotent. It cannot just do anything. Chance interactions do not lead to an unlimited variety of outcomes. And I give this example. How long have we been waiting in this universe? 13.8 billion years for the, and then think about what has the raw material of this universe been able to generate in that time? Well, not an unlimited number of atoms. I don't mean number of atoms total, but number of kinds of atoms. Roughly 92, 94 naturally occurring elements. We don't have thousands of naturally occurring elements because the limitations of the laws of nature prevent the natural formation of atoms with, say, 200 protons or an isotope of carbon with 53 neutrons. That's not going to happen no matter how long we wait, because the properties of this universe do not support that kind of an outcome. So there are limits of nature. And again, taking it to the multiverse, which I've found again in my readings, is often sort of the expanded version of the genie in the bottle. Well, if our universe can't have the resources to produce life out of non-life, then let's just imagine that there's a multiverse of universes, and with that bigger sample size, surely it can happen there. But my experience of nature is if you've got more stuff, you've got more of the same. And there's no reason to suppose that a multiverse, even if this multiverse generating mechanism exists, would create an infinite spectrum of universes with an infinite range of parameter spaces and forces and so on. Most likely it would just be within a certain range and a certain number of outcomes and a lot of repetition of the same thing, because that's what we see by studying this universe. Let's see here. My slides are not advancing, so I'm going to try to do it by hand here, changing that. Let's see, hopefully that shows up as information theory in life. This is one of the topics that I've been fascinated by for a very long time, probably since the 1980s, that there's a vast amount of information in living systems and a limited amount of information in the non-living universe. And that the natural processes of nature do not systematically increase the information content of a system with the passage of time, but rather, if anything, they would act to decrease it. This is described in general, kind of in statistical thermal physics, sometimes called the new generalized second law, a generalized second law of thermodynamics, not just the kind that you probably heard about in a first year physics course, but a generalized second law that draws upon results of quantum mechanics. Tells us that the natural machinery does not exist to systematically increase the complexity of biological structures with the passage of time. And or if you even start with the non-living universe, the natural machinery of this universe does not work to increase the information content with the passage of time. So that means that whatever natural information content the universe had at the moment of the Big Bang is the maximum that it will ever have. And that natural processes would seek to decrease that with the passage of time. But the input of information required to generate life would represent an exponential increase in the information content of the universe at that moment, which there is no reason to suspect that that could ever happen by natural processes, and every reason to expect that that is a violation of natural laws. It's a miraculous event from a naturalistic point of view. Another difficulty, you might say, for naturalism to explain, I feel, would be the origin of our minds, our consciousness, our rationality. And if anyone tries to assert that our thoughts are simply the result of atomic interactions, essentially the electromagnetic force. I mean, I'm teaching electrodynamics right now. And electric forces are pretty limited to pushes and pulls. And to imagine that pushes and pulls between charged particles could result by themselves without any intelligent intervention could result in a conscious mind such as we possess. There's no warrant for that within the laws of physics. Other philosophers have realized this, that if our thoughts are only random physical states of molecules, which make up the neurons of our brains, we could not think. Our thoughts would only follow the laws of nature, and they would not be able to be trusted or to be productive. So let's look at what I believe God can create, obviously life, and just looking at a child, there is so much more there than just a pile of atoms interacting. I remember when my daughter was born and I first saw her, you know, at that moment, looking into her eyes and her eyes looking into mine, I realized there's somebody there. There's a person there. There's a personhood, an individual. And again, there's something more than can be explained by natural processes. I like to consider the aspect of beauty as well, from a almost a scientific philosophical point of view. There's outward beauty that can be described by things like symmetry, maybe proportion, harmony, but then there's something known as a depth of beauty. And you can immediately tell the difference looking at a face of a plastic doll versus a face of a human child, that there's something more going on than just outward manifestations. Now, if we think about more, what can nature produce on its own? We can just look at examples of what nature is good at making. I've shown two here, both composed of H2O molecules. A snowflake in the crystalline form of water, frozen, shows a regular structure that's periodic. It has very specific, bond angles. It's repetitious of that specificity, but it's not complex in the sense that it's not showing a range of variety like we would see in the complexity of the letters that make up the words of a book. Nature can produce complexity, such as in the photograph of the cloud. The positions of all the water molecules in that cloud at any given instant, along with their vector velocities. It's extremely complex. There's no way to predict it exactly. But the deal with this that undermines its information content is that it is not specific. It's random. You could have an airplane fly through that cloud, a jet airplane. I've been flying a lot lately, and just a couple of days ago, landed through a cloud into Indianapolis. And guess what? The cloud was a cloud before the airplane flew through it, and it was a cloud after the airplane flew through it. You can stir up a cloud and it doesn't cease becoming a cloud or being a cloud. You can stir up a snowflake and it would break up the arrangement of that pattern, but the molecules could refreeze and form another snowflake. However, if you tried to look at this one of the cells within a living organism, whether it's from a plant or an animal, if you took even one cell, and if you could imagine putting a needle into it and stirring it up, no amount of time that you wait would allow that to settle back down. Nor could you say that after you stirred up the cell, well, it's still a cell. Just like stirring up the cloud, it's still a cloud. And the reason is that the cell has complexity and specificity. And of course, we know that it's a functional arrangement of molecules that are accomplishing a specific outcome. And there's a high level of information content in the living organism. And there's a relatively low level of information content in these other types of structures that nature can make. Even in stars, one of the things that the universe is good at making, hundreds of billions of stars in a galaxy like the Milky Way or the Andromeda Galaxy. But if you stirred up a star with some giant stirring stick, imagine that, it might disrupt the gradients of pressure and density and temperature. It might cease producing as much heat by fusion as it did before. But if you waited long enough, took the stirring stick out, those same particles would settle back down and become a star and probably start undergoing fusion just like they did before, and it would not look any different. So stars also have low information content compared to even a single cell. But I think there's a connection between this high information content of living systems and the type of depth of beauty which we see in them that is not apparent in just outwardly beautiful structures. So I think that beauty itself, in the kind of beauty we appreciate, which is known as radiance, something that shows depth of form, also is a clue, a marker for something beyond nature. So on the left, we have a photo of a model of part of a DNA molecule, on the right, a model of a single protein molecule. And either one of these, if they were stirred up, would not settle down again into that structure. There has been no recorded example of a protein molecule, such as we would find within a human cell, forming by natural processes, because the information content is too great. You can't have a starting solution which has a certain information content and then wait and have that information content increase with time. The protein has far more information than is found in the starting solution. So that's why it doesn't form with the passage of time, in complete agreement with that what I mentioned earlier and called the generalized second law of thermodynamics. So just a few more talks about the topic of beauty. Nature is a child. I drew some scribbles here. I'm a child in my artistic ability to compare to, say, an artist, such as Michelangelo. Nature is a child. It can produce an endless variety of patterns. Some are recognizably beautiful, but the type of beauty seen in nature can all be explained by the laws of physics. The absorption of the different wavelengths of sunlight as it passes through the atmosphere at this low angle can explain the reddish yellowish colors as the blue light is scattered more intensely. The reflection off the waves, the formation of the waves themselves, all of those things are explainable by the laws of physics that we know. But there is no application of the laws of physics that can explain the origin of a living cell, starting with a random collection of the appropriate atoms. So nature is just unable to create a masterpiece. It's good at producing childlike, simpler, you know, beautiful arrangements of atoms. But if you ever saw nature in a sunset produce what was not just, oh, I think I could maybe imagine that looks like a face there in the clouds, but if you saw clearly depicted an image in the clouds of someone you knew with a lot of detail, you should definitely take a picture of that, because that would be beyond anything that's ever been seen before. So nature is kind of governed by laws, forces, what we might call conservation principles. There's freedom, like I would describe freedom as nature following the first law of Newton, first law of motion that Newton proposed, that an object will continue in straight line motion, unaccelerated motion, unless acted on by an outside force. So this is what we've got: freedom and then laws. Result in specified simplicity, such as crystallization, or random complexity, such as cloud or rock formations, but very limited depth of beauty, which is characterized by specified complexity. Now, some would say that, well, okay, nature maybe can't produce a cell all at once, but what we can do is kind of ratchet our way up slowly, step by step, until we've got it after enough time. And so this is what I call the myth of the information ratchet. And an example from physics that is very similar to this is the idea of Maxwell's demon. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but the idea is shown in the graphic below at the bottom of the page. You've got a box with gas in it and a partition down the middle and a little trap door with some imp here or demon who can watch the molecules, and he, let's say, wants to collect all the ones with the higher velocity than average on the right-hand side. And so he opens the door when the higher velocity molecules come toward the right-hand side, and he closes it when the slow ones come. And pretty soon he's made a separation that leads to a pressure gradient. And so in a sense, he's collected energy without any effort, except for just his observations in opening and closing the little door. And why doesn't that work? Well, it was actually a few decades before the proper scientific answer was given by Szilard, I believe you pronounce it. And he pointed out that the energy it takes to gain the information, to discern if the molecules are moving faster or slower than average, that amount of energy always will exceed the amount of energy you can gain by collecting the molecules on one side. So you really can't get something for nothing. You can't get energy by using information in this way. And I think that the same idea applies, that you cannot use any information source to gain information, which is the essence of the theory of evolution. Let's ratchet up information by some means. Of course, there has to be some energy. But I believe that we can assert that the reverse process to this kind of a failure of Maxwell's demon, that the reverse process cannot be used to produce the success of generating information through some sort of a ratcheting mechanism. That's the essence of what I'm saying. The initial information needed to make a selection always exceeds any possible gain in the information. So the information output of a machine cannot exceed the information pre-existing within the machine. Like, there is no such thing as a printing press that can produce new books. The information to print the book is pre-programmed into the printing press, if you want to use that old knowledge or old technology. But if you want to say, I've got a file, a PDF that contains my book, which I do, I can print that PDF file and get a copy of my book. But the book that's printed does not contain any more information that is in the PDF already. And if you think that by printing it many times, I'm going to get a new chapter, a new conclusion, a new paragraph, new information, that's just not going to happen. So any information that exists in a system cannot be increased by a natural mechanism. There are no natural information ratchets. Now, just another couple of things that will be done here. Addressing the issue of fine-tuning. Some have dismissed fine-tuning arguments, which I know are a large part of what Reasons to Believe publications have promoted. And I find them, you know, extremely useful and convincing evidence for design. Some have tried to dismiss it by saying, well, this is a non-argument, because if the universe was not designed to support life, we wouldn't be here because we wouldn't be alive. So of course the universe has to be designed, if you want to use the word design, or of course the universe has to have a set of parameters that support life. I would agree with that. That's just common sense. However, what we find in the actual universe by examining it is case after case of extreme knife-edge fine-tuning. The reality, as I show here, for the fine-tuning is sharp. The only thing that's necessary is that the physical parameters generally, broadly, take on values that allow life to exist. It's not necessary for the range of physical parameters to support life to be knife edge finely tuned. So what we see is far more than just the necessity to allow life to exist. There's a clue here. There's something to be wondered at, something that may point us, I believe, legitimately towards a designer. So I think that this then kind of handles or takes care of that common objection to the fine-tuning argument. I found from my study of physics, I did a whole semester study on quantum computing, and it's interesting that physics, as expressed here by John Wheeler, a well-known and respected physicist, lived throughout most of the 1900s, kind of proposed that information is actually the fundamental quantity or entity within the universe. He coined this phrase, it from bit, meaning it, everything comes from bit, meaning information. And a quantum physicist, Anton Zeilinger, who is commenting on this, states, in conclusion, it may very well be said that information is the irreducible kernel from which everything else flows. Now, when I read that, my mind as a believer makes the connection to John 1:1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And God made the universe through him, and without him, nothing was made that was made. I was so pleased to find this quantum physicist quote where he's saying the same thing. He says it might even be fair to observe that the concept that information is fundamental is, as he says, very old knowledge of humanity. Very old, as in it's been in the Bible for the last 2,000 years. Witness, for example, the beginning of the gospel according to John. In the beginning was the Word. So I quote this in my book, Canceled Science. I was, again, pleased to find that kind of an affirmation of this concept, which, again, you know, this man, Professor Zeilinger, is, you know, famous physicist, well known. Maybe he can get away with that, but if I tried to say something like that in my Ball State Boundaries of Science class, I think that was one of the type of implications of the study of nature that my antagonist used to somehow accuse me of pushing religion in the classroom. I'd say that the nature that the atheists believe is all there is, if you look at it, promotes and declares religion. It declares the glory of God, as the psalmist says. So some people have asked me, and this is our last slide here, you know, what's your strongest argument for the existence of God? And I'd say, well, you know, all of these evidences from nature, some of which we've talked about, others are in my book. There's many more I'm sure you know about. They're great. I affirm them. I'm pleased every time I see these new fine-tuning examples and so on, and even logical arguments for the existence of God. Those are great, but my strongest assurances of faith come from evidence that could best be described as spiritual. And I believe that this is in line with what we should be led to expect from the scriptures, that the Spirit of God within us actually witnesses to the truth of what we believe. Some demand proof for God before they believe. I don't know that proof, beyond a possible doubt, as my friend Rice Brooks would say, is possible. In a court of law, we're only really required to provide proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And then we make a conclusion, reaching the best conclusion based on the available evidence. I believe that the evidence is quite sufficient to point to design and the significance of our lives. And I believe that as we study nature even more, it seems to be the trend, as Dr. Ross has pointed out, that the more we study nature, the more evidences for God's hand of design, this imprint of Christ in creation, become available and become apparent to us. So as a physicist, it's a great privilege to be able to study nature and to be able to interpret the discoveries in a way that I can appreciate, point to a designer, and I just pray that we can all participate in being able to help disseminate those key pieces of evidence to help people to come to take a step of trust towards God and to strengthen the faith of those that do already believe. So here's just a picture of my book where I summarize a lot more of my story of what happened at Ball State and how kind of the outcome of that went, as well as presenting the bulk of the book on examining nature and presenting kind of my interpretation of that, of how it does point to a designer. So I want to say thank you so much for your attention. And I am finished with my part of the talk here, but looking forward to some good interactions in the question time. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hedin. We do have some questions coming up.
Great.
The first one is from Doug McComb, who says, I've read that Billy Graham, Franklin Graham, Dwight Moody, Charles Spurgeon, Jonathan Wesley, pretty much all of the great preachers, had a time in their life after conversion where they had a struggle of faith and eventually came out of it with a powerful rededication to the Lord. Doug's question is, have you heard of this? And secondly, could you say that you ever had such a time in your life?
Thank you for that question. And I mean, that's a very interesting question. And I would have to say that for me personally, I've never gone through a complete crisis of faith. I think that in my experience throughout life, there's been kind of an ongoing willingness to be exposed to challenges to my faith, to allow myself to ask a question. And every time I have done so, I've found that the evidence points back to God. Whether it's evidence from science that an interpretation of the scriptures that shows how they harmonize, or whether it's in my own kind of spiritual experience of God. Honestly, I can say that I've never set out to find more of the Lord, to experience more of him, and found nothing. I've never kind of just come up with a blank in my desire to seek God. There's always been, you know, God is faithful. He's been there. He's shown me more, and I'm grateful for that.
Thank you. Dr. Von Mancha says, atheists ignore the, I think it's the Bohr, Vilenkin, Guth theorem as only classical. Doesn't Kobe and Planck circumvent this arm waving over the Planck epoch?
So you said Planck, and what was the other word? Kobe, you said?
Yeah, C-O-B-E.
Oh, okay. Right, so referring to those satellites measuring evidence from the cosmic background radiation. And from those, the name of that theorem that you mentioned, those three researchers who came up with that theorem, my understanding is that the outcome of that is that for any universe that has been in general, expanding throughout its history for any possible model of a universe, and subject to certain quite general conditions, that it points back to a true singularity. And I think that that's the case still, that I'm sure Dr. Ross could speak to this more cogently, more authoritatively, but I believe that the current situation is that the essence of the result of their theorem still holds, and that the evidence still points back to a true singularity out of which our universe began.
Thank you. Tom Wee from Germany says, thanks very much for sharing your experience. There are evangelical Christian universities which discourage the teaching of design and science and emphasize the teaching of evolution. Is it possible for a Christian university to teach and train scientists at a graduate level while accepting design or non-naturalist principles?
Oh, well, I certainly believe it's possible. And when I taught at Biola University in Southern California, the faculty there were a number of them cutting edge researchers in biochemistry, for example, in physics, who were totally dedicated to the truth of God as creator and the evidence of design in nature. Biola did not, and I don't believe it does at this point, have a graduate study program in the sciences. They do in theology and so on in other fields, but not in the sciences. But there is no reason why a school could not have a solid graduate program in science and still have faculty who are committed and knowledgeable in the field of science that points to design.
Thank you. Belinda Calabias asks, if you were an atheist, would you have taken a different approach to your boundaries of science course?
Now, that's an interesting question. I don't know how many of you have ever imagined what you would think if you were an atheist. So it's a little hard for me to put myself in a identity like that and imagine what I might do or think. But from what I know of other people who are atheists and scientists, some honestly are kind of open to the idea of stretching the boundaries, looking at maybe metaphysical implications of nature. Others, from what I have seen, who are atheists, are all about pushing the opposite story, that it's all random, it's all natural, and we are therefore nothing but the most insignificant speck of dust. And so, I mean, not all atheists have the same kind of agenda to try to drill down naturalism. Some maybe are saying, I'm an atheist now, I don't really believe in God, but I'm just fascinated by this universe, and let's talk about it. So it probably would depend on the person. And if I were that person, I don't know. I'm not, and I could only imagine.
I think you did a good job trying to imagine that. So my compliments to the chef on that one.
Thank you.
Mark Durham asks, many naturalists today appeal to panspermia to avoid the information problem for life on Earth. How do you view that problem?
Oh, well, that's a great question. I've heard even Richard Dawkins, if you've watched the Expelled movie that Ben Stein put together, he interviews Richard Dawkins, who, when asked about how did life begin, basically suggests that it could have come about by this directed panspermia idea from some ancient advanced civilization who Dawkins makes pains to point out came about by some evolutionary process in the earlier history of the universe. And then they became very advanced and they sent out seeds of life that somehow came to Earth, and voila, here we have humans now. So I feel like Dawkins is, you know, really not being realistic there from a scientific point of view. As Dr. Ross has pointed out, there's a limited time window within the universe where life can develop. Just to get the raw ingredients, the atoms that are necessary, the particular elements that are necessary for living systems, takes a certain amount of time of stellar life cycles, stellar processes, generations of stars, going supernova and enriching the interstellar medium with the heavier elements, even carbon, and heavier elements necessary for life. So to appeal to some pre-existing ancient civilization, which presumably took billions of years to develop, that would have had to have started billions of years earlier than our Earth, I think is actually outside of the realm of possibility from what we know of, say, just stellar nucleosynthesis at this point. Plus, there's no reason to expect that that life form, whatever it might have been, could have broken the laws of information theory and succeeded in developing on its own. So it's just punting, as they say. It's taking the impossibility of the situation and just punting it back to some obscure time in history and saying maybe it happened then.
Thank you. Tim Williams asks, how have you found unbelieving physicists or other scientists to handle the fine tuning found in the universe?
Well, I believe that, I mean, this is a good question. And if this is the Tim Williams I know, hello. The most common kind of argument explaining it away, I think I mentioned, or at least I hinted at in my talk, is that, well, of course there's fine tuning. If there wasn't, we wouldn't be here to even think about it. Some also might argue that, well, we don't really know the range possible for parameters such as the strength of gravity. And so to assign a probability to it existing within the range that it does is hard to do. And I'll leave that to the probability theorists. But I think the best kind of counter argument is just to point out how we aren't seeing one or two or maybe a dozen examples of fine tuning. It's pervasive, and it's not in one area of study of nature, but it's throughout. It's in universal parameters of physics, in cosmology. It's in parameters that deal with the universe as a whole. It's in parameters that deal with stellar energy production. The fine tuning is, as Dr. Ross has so brilliantly illustrated in his book, Improbable Planet, is pervasive in planet Earth being able to support life. And if you look then in living systems, we've got Dr. Rana's new book, Fit for a Purpose, that is just, again, over and over illustrating fitness of biochemical systems to allow life. And so at pretty much every level we examine the universe, you've got this. And I think to just keep dismissing it, it's like, oh, well, it doesn't really matter. Oh, well, it had to be there. Oh, well, it doesn't mean anything. Oh, well, you don't have the probabilities well-defined. That gets tiresome after a while. That's just honestly not a legitimate scientific counter-argument in my mind.
Thank you. Belinda Calavia asks, I guess, would you, as a Christian, change your approach to teaching your course now in a secular university? Any comments to support Christian professors in secular university?
I would probably do it again, because I really don't believe that I was overstepping the bounds of propriety in terms of what was being said or the discussions I was allowing students to have. I mean, it was a very discussion-based class. I'd write an open-ended question on the board and get them into groups of five and let them go at it. And then we'd hear from the students and let them reach their own conclusions. But I have heard so many examples of professors with agendas on the naturalistic side of things, pushing their agendas in the classroom. And so based on a comparison with that, I feel like I was very gentle, very careful. And so one thing that's important is to realize that there probably will be opposition, but that doesn't mean it's all over. There are groups who are very supportive, like I mentioned in my talk, but there are even legal groups who can help to defend if it comes down to that in a courtroom situation, and they tend to win their arguments in support of, say, freedom of speech or academic freedom. Now, Ball State University claimed that what I was doing was violating academic integrity. That was, they knew they wouldn't get away with saying I was violating academic freedom or, you know, something like that, because that kind of was on my side. But academic integrity, what did they mean by that? They meant that when I, they accused me of teaching intelligent design, that was the main kind of thrust of the course, that I was teaching intelligent design in a science course. And they came up with statements from various scientific societies saying that intelligent design, which they quickly then morphed into creation science, was not science. And so they said, you were hired to teach a science course and curriculum, and here you are not teaching science because you're mentioning intelligent design. And that's quite debatable as to whether or not intelligent design is not a legitimate pursuit. But what is true is that I hardly ever mentioned that in the classroom, if ever. I just, you know, wanted to say, can nature do this? Is this outside the realms of natural possibility? What do you think? Is this natural? And so there's different ways to be a witness in the classroom. It can go a long way just with your character. And people see something different in someone who has the spirit of Christ on them. And that Christ-like attitude and way of relating with people, no matter what you're teaching, I think can carry a lot of weight as a witness. So seek the Lord, ask him for guidance, and follow your heart as you are in prayer. I believe God will guide you. Can't predict exactly the outcome of whatever that journey might be, but I know that the Lord will be with you if you are careful to just be waiting on him. Thank you for that question.
Yeah, thank you. You know, you represent very much the core of what Reasons to Believe represents, and that is to give every person an answer with gentleness and respect. And I think you've manifested that beautifully. So my compliments. Thank you very much for that.
Well, thank you for those words. That means so much to me. I really appreciate that.
I have a question about methods that you might recommend to, let's say, Reasons to Believe, to reach out to young people. College age, high school age, do you have any ideas? Do they like books, pamphlets, videos? You know, in your experience, what seems to actually grip them?
Well, I'm maybe not the best source. I'm a little on the older side compared to college students right now. But I have been on a lot of college campuses lately and in interactions with college students. And it seems that a short video clip can be attention getting with, you know, just presenting something in a almost a semi-humorous or just well-delivered, fast-paced manner. On a on a specific topic of interest, you know, like, is there evidence for God? Well, here's three simple points that say what it is, or, you know, just addressing a question in a fairly short, maybe when I say short, less than 5 minute clip answer. Mm-hmm. So I think that can be something. I think that if we can get onto campuses and speak to students, that's helpful. I've been involved in some of that lately with a group called God's Not Dead Events, and able to go to college campuses and present an outreach with evidence for God in an age of uncertainty is the subtitle of that. And we've been seeing a couple hundred students on average come to each of the events. And, you know, it's an evening long, you know, a lot of Q&A time, and students are coming to that with questions, and a number are responding with an indication of faith in Christ as well. So,
wow, that's fantastic. Thank you for that. I appreciate that very much. Yeah. Our time is up. We're done with the questions. Is there anything you'd like to close with, or should we just say thank you very much and have a nice day?
I would just want to say thank you again for this opportunity to share. It's been a blessing to me. And again, one of the things that I appreciate most about Reasons to Believe, besides just the books and the newsletters and so on, is this commitment that I see to prayer, to believing that God is real, and it is worthwhile to take time to pray, to seek Him. And so I want to say, please keep prioritizing that faith in God and seeking God through prayer for His direction and His success in your endeavors. And I join you in prayer for that, and believe that God will continue to use you. And I'm blessed to see the ways that God has been opening up doors, even internationally, you know, translations of books into different languages. I think this is being accelerated, and that we can expect more of that in the future. So may the Lord bless you and provide all the resources and the energy and the just inspiration to be able to respond to the opportunities. In Jesus' name. Yeah.
Thank you. And thank you for allowing the Lord to bless us through you.
Oh, well, thank you again.
So with that, have a good rest of the day. And thank you very much. Good day to everyone. Bye-bye.
Goodbye, everyone. Thank you.